Welcome to Section 8C, What is the Appropriate Price for a Community Rated Product, by Carl Newman. Just a bit of housekeeping before I go into what Carl does and where he's from. Remember that the feedback forms, please complete the feedback forms and don't fold them. Apparently they're computer read and the machines can't read it if you fold it. For purposes of recording, please approach the mic and speak clearly and state your name. Turn off your mobile phones, obviously. And the format of the presentation will be Carl will speak and then questions and discussion at the end. Just a bit about Carl. Carl's from FIAC, the regulator of the health insurance industry. He's been at FIAC for about 5 years and focuses on insurance and capital risks, specifically pricing, profitability, capital management, strategy, and risk mitigation measures. He also works with risk rating insurers. His role includes risk rating insurers, developing internal analytical tools, and has provided advice to the Minister of Health and Aging applications on premium increases for the last five rounds. And prior to FIAC, he was at ABS. Carl's a AIAA and one of the first chartered and price risk actuaries. Please welcome Carl.
Thanks for that, Ben. In tackling this topic, I went from very much a first principles type approach. So I went back to kind of the first actuarial techniques you get taught when you start out down this journey becoming an actuary. And to... No, that's not going to work. Okay. No?
Try page down.
Okay, there we go. And went back to actuarial techniques 101. And also I thought it was useful for an actuarial paper to have at least one formula in it. So I'm not sure if this really counts, but I'll go with that. Now, essentially that teaches you that to calculate the price for a policy, you calculate the expected benefits that you're likely to pay, add a bit for administrative expenses, plus for your profit, and then you take away a little bit for your investment revenue. Generally speaking, the premium is largely dependent on the expected benefits that are going to be paid. That's generally the main driver and the most complicated calculation in determining the premium of a policy. Now, in private health insurance, and I'm looking specifically at the hospital products for this, in private health insurance, the benefits are mainly paid to hospitals and medical practitioners as a result of people being admitted to hospitals and undergoing specific types of procedures. So to calculate the expected benefits, it's almost a question of, well, what are the people's health likely to be, and what sort of medical services are they likely to undergo? So then how do you determine what the health of the persons covered is likely to be going forward, and what influences that? The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has put together a framework on the determinants of health. Now, as you can see, there's a lot of factors up there, from genetic factors and physical factors such as age and genetic makeup to biomedical factors, body weight, blood pressure, health behaviours, whether you smoke, whether you don't, how much you drink, diet, exercise, as well as socioeconomic factors and societal influences. Now, I'm not sure if you can actually read all of that, but the point was that there's a huge amount of factors that go into determining the health of an individual and thereby their likely benefits and their likely use of medical services. So these are the sort of factors you'd want to look at in assessing whether a person is going to use medical services or not and what the likely cost of those are. Of course, working in a community-rated industry, the ability to gather this information is a bit limited. And the ability to use any of these factors to determine a premium is limited again. So you've got the factors that affect benefits and the factors that you can use, which makes it a little bit difficult. Now, technically, I possibly could have put state up in the right-hand column, as you can differentiate by the state on which the persons live. And there are two reasons why I excluded that from this slide. Is one, it'd probably be a bit of a interesting link between the health of a person and the state in which they live. And the other reason, so that's one of the reasons I didn't include it, and the other reason is that, well, it would have messed up my slide a little bit, and I kind of liked it like that. So, now, of course, there is risk equalisation as well, which is a very important factor in private health insurance, and I'm going to come back to this factor a little bit later on. So how do you determine the expected value of benefits when you can't use any of these factors, and you don't know necessarily what they are? Now, of course, all insurers are in the same boat. So what is their view as to the appropriate price for this product? A couple of years ago, the Private Health Insurance Ombudsman created a website comparing every product from every insurer. And it also includes a search function for comparing similar products, or at least products that the Ombudsman considers to be similar. And these are the results from that. Now, as you can see, there's a large price difference for top hospital cover in New South Wales. The difference between number 21 down here and number 23 is about 73%. Now, this one looks to be a little bit of an outlier, as it's all by its lonesome, so I use the second cheapest one as a basis for the index. But even so, you're looking at a difference about 42%, despite the Ombudsman considering all these products to be comparable. So when you're looking at what the appropriate price is, I'm like, well, what is it? Who's right? Who's wrong? Is everybody right? Can you use this data to make direct comparisons on what the prices should be? And the answer to the last question is, well, probably not. There are going to be a lot of differences between insurers, and which, of course, will result in a different price. Some insurers may want to have an outlet on every corner so people can go in and speak to someone. Other insurers may go for more of an online type approach. Similarly, insurers will have different management expenses, claims management processes, contracting arrangements, profit margins, and all those you would expect to come through the price. Similarly, while these products are comparable, they're not identical. So there will be differences in cover provided. But if you can address these factors and compare identical products from insurers with very similar back-of-office efficiencies, similar management expenses, similar claims management processes, broader health cover initiatives, then the comparison does become more meaningful. For example, comparing Medibank's Blue Ribbon product offered in Victoria to Medibank's Blue Ribbon product offered in the Northern Territory. Now, as you can see, the price difference between the two states is 80%. And just so I'm not seen to be purely picking on Medibank, a comparison of Australia's other major insurer, Bupa, and its top hospital cover, reveals very similar results. The price difference between Bupa's products is 83%. This is despite the underlying products, of course, being identical and offered by the same insurer. And that kind of leads to the question of this paper. Well, what is the appropriate price for a community-rated product? And particularly, what's the appropriate price of Medibank's Blue Ribbon product or Bupa's top hospital product? Now, one difference that you may note is that there's a different calculated deficit in each state, which will thereby affect the premium. But how much of a difference in price does that account for? And then you're also left to wonder, well, why is the calculated deficit so different? If I can pose another question to you, what would happen if, hypothetically, insurers were no longer able to differentiate between people in the Northern Territory and Victoria? So people had to be charged the same premium. How would this change the appropriate price if they both had to be charged the same amount? Now, if I can leave those two factors with you for a moment and cover some administrative matters. The first thing is that in giving this presentation, I'm speaking on behalf of myself. The views that I'm expressing are not necessarily those of the organisations which I'm affiliated with. And also, I thought it could be worthwhile to outline a bit of background as to what made me decide to do this paper in the first place. And there are largely two reasons for that. The first is that a lot of the discussion in the industry focuses on drawing rates and how drawing rates change. And I thought it could be interesting to come from the other perspective and ask, well, what is the appropriate price? What should the price be? Also, when insurers find themselves in financial difficulty, they're often referred to as having prices that are inappropriate. Now, while that may be true at that point in time, generally it's preceded by a period, 1, 2, 3, 4 years earlier, where the prices were profitable, and at least on the face of it, were sustainable. And in my mind, and we won't get into a detailed discussion of how things work in my mind, but for this matter, in my mind, it's been, well, what changed? How did the price of this product that did appear to be sustainable suddenly become inappropriate to the extent that it can jeopardise the viability of an entire insurer? I hope to go some way to answering that question today. Now, I outlined that this presentation, you don't really need a background in private health insurance to attend, so I did include a background slide. And looking around, most of the faces I recognise, but there are some that I don't. So if I can just ask a quick show of hands as to who has a reasonable background in private health insurance. Pretty much half. Would anyone be really offended if I don't quote pieces of legislation to you? Excellent. Okay. There were a few people that said they didn't have a background in private health insurance, so I'll just quickly skim through this. Essentially, the industry works on a community-rated basis, so you can't differentiate on who you cover. You can't charge a different premium to an old person or a young person, to a person who is sick, to a person who is healthy. You can't differentiate in any way on the likely claiming pattern that the person is likely to, at an individual level, that the expected claims that they are likely to incur. Risk equalisation is a system that underpins that, seeks to equalise the costs associated with older members and sicker members. Portability, you can jump around from insurer to insurer, basically at your whim, provided you're on a similar product. There are waiting periods that do apply, but they're limited to 12 months, at least on the hospital side. Lifetime health cover loading, if you join a policy after the age of 30, sorry, after the age of 31, you'll be, no, sorry, after the age of 30, you'll be charged an extra 2% per premium depending on, well, every age over 30 you are when you join. Similarly, there's a Medicare levy surcharge to encourage people to take out private health insurance, and for an insurer to change its prices, it has to be approved by the Minister for Health. I thought it could be interesting to include an example of some of the different types of people that result of a community-rated environment that are charged exactly the same premium. And as you can see, the premium to a 30-year-old male with an expected claim pattern of about $230 is charged the same amount as an 85-year-old with an expected claim pattern of $4,500. Similarly, a family with one child is charged the same premium as a family with 15 children. 30-year-old who exercises regularly, eats well, and is in shape is charged the same as a 30-year-old that is a chain smoker, morbidly obese, and has a poor diet. Now, there are a number of other examples that you can use, but I thought it was just interesting to reiterate that the people underpinning a policy can have a very different claiming pattern, yet as a result of community rating, they all have to be charged the same amount. Now, for the topic of what is the appropriate price, you probably need to define a little bit about what do I mean by the appropriate price. Now, there are a large amount of factors that would be considered in determining what the price of a product should be. So you have the insurer's objectives, the insurer's risk appetite, costs, commercial and competitive considerations, and a whole raft of other things that you would that would generally be incorporated into determining a price. For the purpose of this paper and this presentation, I'm going to limit it a fair bit to one that is not loss-making, so effectively has a net margin of zero or greater than zero, and one which returns a consistent level of performance across the years, either gross or net margin. Now, the actual level of performance is fairly immaterial. Whether you go for a 2% net margin or a 50% net margin doesn't really matter for the purpose of this. The key is that it's consistent. Excuse me. For a product, what I mean by product is a product within a state. So for Medibank's Blue Ribbon, Medibank's Blue Ribbon single, couple, family, single parent, etc., is considered the same product, but the same product offered in different states is considered a different product for the purpose of this. And of course, different insurers offering different products is similarly a different product. So then we get back to this slide about what is the appropriate price for these products. Now, assuming that the products in the Northern Territory and Victoria fall under the category of appropriately priced, which, knowing Andrew and Tori as I do, I'm sure is a very reasonable assumption to make, the gross margin for these products would be expected to be similar, or at least on Medibank's part and on Bupa's part. So if the gross margin of the products is similar, that means that the drawing rates or benefits that are paid are a similar proportion of the premium received. In other words, the drawing rates or claims of people in Victoria is 80% more than the people in the Northern Territory. If people in the Northern Territory had a similar claiming pattern as people in Victoria, prices in the Northern Territory would be incurring significant losses. And further, they would need to almost double to obtain a level of profitability. So it seems to suggest that the price reflects the claiming pattern of the people on the product, and those in the Northern Territory just have a very different claiming pattern than those in Victoria. So this leads to the question, well, why are the drawing rates so different, and what are the factors that affect this? Now, there are a huge amount of factors that affect drawing rates, and the paper spends a fair bit of time discussing all of these. Now, in the interest of time, I'm going to skim through these fairly quickly. Now, obviously, the demographics of a product expect to have a large impact. As I mentioned previously, older people generally claim more than younger people, so you have more older people on a product, they're generally going to claim more than younger people. Now, of course, there is this risk equalisation again, which I'm going to come back to. Demographics alone, though, won't fully explain experience, and 2 30-year-olds, 2 60-year-olds are not going to have the same claiming pattern. Now, demographics is perhaps one of the largest reasons that for the difference between prices in Northern Territory and Victoria. Northern Territory is just a lot younger than, has a lot younger people on it than Victoria. Victoria is a very old demographic. Similarly, the access to services perhaps is another reason why the price in the Northern Territory is so much lower than they are in Victoria. In the Northern Territory, there are 2 private hospitals, both of which are in Darwin, and only 1 caters to overnight patients. So for a policyholder living in Alice Springs, their closest private hospital is 1,500 kilometres away. You'd expect that would have a fairly reasonable impact on a person's utilisation. Similarly, the cost of medical treatment has an impact and how medical conditions are treated, honeymoons and spikes, which I'll come back to in a moment, risk equalisation, whether people get treatment in public or private hospitals, and, of course, the Medicare benefit schedule and the government's prostheses list also affect the total amount of claims. Now, I would like to speak about 2 of these in a little bit of detail, and the first is honeymoons, spikes and waiting periods. And I know Andrew and there was a lot of had a session on this yesterday, so I'm going to skim through this fairly quickly. But as was mentioned, that people have different claiming patterns depending on how long they've been with an insurer. People on waiting periods are obviously going to, well, not be able to claim, so I'm going to have a lower drawing rate than people that have been, or that are physically able to claim. So when a product's growing, those on waiting periods, like I said, won't be able to claim. So if you're looking at drawing rates as a whole, they're generally going to be lower on products that are growing than those that aren't. If you don't specifically consider this, you may find it has a little bit of a sting in its tail later on, as was discussed yesterday. Let's skip through that. And yeah, the big thing with growth is that when those people are on waiting periods, the view can be taken that because it has reduced drawing rates, is that it can be mistaken that this growth is good new members, it's profitable growth, and the insurer can now charge a lower premium as a result. Rather being viewed as just a lull in claiming patterns that are a result of people not physically being able to make a claim. Now, the other thing I'd like to talk about briefly is, in terms of what affects drawing rates, is risk equalisation. And there is no doubt that risk equalisation has an enormous impact on reducing the severity of the factors that I mentioned previously. The net impact on an insurer of an 85-year-old is not going to be, 20 times more than the impact of a 30-year-old because of risk equalisation. But, and this may be a little bit controversial, but in my view, the drawing rates after risk equalisation are not fungible. They're not identical. It will not equalise the costs exactly. So when you're looking at SAUs and drawing rates after risk equalisation, they're not going to be the same across everyone on the products. And this is also one of the reasons, in my view, that enables insurers to charge different amounts for the same for different products. If drawing rates were identical after risk equalisation, then the ability to charge different prices, even though the product is different, may be very limited. So it gets back to, well, what is the appropriate price for a product? And it seems to, well, depend. Who are you covering? And how much are they likely to claim? Two insurers can potentially offer identical products with very different prices. If they insure a different group of people that just claim less than another insurer, they can charge a lower premium. I mean, after all, it doesn't require a large premium to provide cover for someone that never claims. So it seems to be largely based on the drawing rates of the persons covered. If I go back to the question I posed to you earlier, what would the price be if you could no longer differentiate prices between Victoria and the Northern Territory? Now, to calculate the appropriate price, you need to maintain a similar margin on the one region as you would in both states. So the total premium revenue received would need to be sufficient to meet your benefits and your expected profit margin. So you'd probably find that would be the result. Now, in terms of how that number was calculated, it's based on two main assumptions. One is that no one from the Northern Territory leaves the product, and two, that the weighted average of the drawing rates of the products is based on the people on top hospital zero excess products in Northern Territory and Victoria. Essentially, the demographic breakdown of one region is 5% in the Northern Territory and 95% in Victoria. Now, what the graph shows is that if that were to happen, the price charged to people from the Northern Territory would increase by about 78%. The price charged to people from Victoria would decrease by around 2%. Despite no underlying change in the drawing rates of either people, for persons from either state, changes in the level of cover, advancements in medical technology, or really any change in their drawing rates on a per-person basis. So in terms of forecasting this forward and what will the appropriate price be, you know, in the next few years, it will not be the same next year as what it is now. That's fairly obvious. At the very least, you have hospital inflation and you have the increase in hospital contracting. But it's only going to be one of the many reasons that can result in the appropriate price changing. Go back to this slide. If we say that the appropriate price is based on all these things, all these factors will change over time. The demographic profile of a product now is not going to be the same as it will be next year. New members will come on board, existing members will lapse, and you know, the existing members will obviously age. Similarly, people's health status change over years as well. Access to medical services can change, cost of medical treatment, and obviously the treatment of medical conditions with technological advances. Interestingly, in Treasury's intergenerational report of 2010, Treasury expects that the impact of on medical expenses from new technologies and from the increase in demand for better quality healthcare to be more than twice that of the impact of the ageing of the population. Now, similarly, well, not so much similarly, but join rates can also be affected by the proportion of people serving waiting periods. If last year you had 10% of your persons covered serving waiting periods, next year it's zero, the overall drawing rates of your products will also change. And similar, that any changes in the other factors will also affect the appropriate price. Now, what I've spoken about today so far centres on the performance of a single product and the drawing rates of a single product. And I've tried to emphasise that the drawing rates of different groups of people can be very different. So in considering what the appropriate price is, it's probably also worthwhile to consider what the relativities is of a particular product to other products in the suite. Of course, in practice, insurers offer multiple products on multiple different coverage levels. A review of the Ombudsman's website shows that there are some insurers that offer 70 different products in a single state for a family cover. And without specifically including product relativities, you might wind up with a situation that some more comprehensive products are charged at a rate below more basic coverage. Of course, the issue with that is if this is recognised and the insurers that, sorry, the persons covered become aware of this, they may jump to the product that provides better cover, claim more in benefits, and potentially the insurer will receive less in premium revenue. Now, this is obviously not a particularly good outcome. Now, I've generally left out the marketability and commercial considerations in the appropriate price. But it's probably worthwhile to give it a little bit of thought as it can have a big impact on the demographic profile of the product. And similarly, if you calculate an appropriate price for a product that you're not going to get any members on board, it's perhaps not an ideal outcome. Now, I mentioned that the price of a product is largely driven by its demographic profile, and this is probably the main difference between Northern Territory and the price in the Northern Territory and the prices in Victoria. So the demographic profile is very important, and of course that will change and age over time. So to gain new members on a product and to reduce the effects of ageing is very important. Thereby, a lot of insurers will seek to grow their products and minimise the effect of this and reduce the increases in drawing rates. But growth can be very, very risky. As was mentioned yesterday, the underlying drawing rates for new people coming on board can be masked for a number of years. Also, the pricing structure that the insurer has may not allow for all types of growth. If I go back to this comparison, now, there are limitations in using this data, but you know, considering the Ombudsman believes these products to be comparable, considering the pricing is regulated in the industry, and considering that the difference between profit margins and management expenses across the industry are not particularly large, it's unlikely that the difference between the product down here and product up here is a result of those factors. Moreover, I suspect that it's just a result of this product covering a group of people and these products covering groups of people that just claim less than the products up here. Now, for example, if an insurer was a small insurer that focused on a membership in rural Victoria and focused on a younger membership, it may be likely that they can charge a cheaper premium than another insurer that focuses on the metropolitan area. And that may very well be sustainable. You have a younger membership, their access to health services is not as great, thereby you can charge a lower premium. But if that changes, then similarly that's going to have an impact on the price. So this may be a consideration in a small insurer with a younger membership, deciding whether or not it should employ a broker or start a mass marketing campaign in the Melbourne CBD, as its prices may just not support that sort of strategic initiative. So in assessing the price of your products, it can be worthwhile as well to identify what is the reason that you can charge the price that you can, and particularly why is it so different to industry. Now, as I mentioned, that maybe if you have a younger membership, maybe that the membership has less access to health services. But then how are you going to have a strategy that supports the sustainability of these price relativities to the industry? And particularly, what is going to be Ben looked at me funny and threw me offline. And what are the factors that will have to result in a large change in price? It's also important to monitor. So the other implications of this, of course, it's important to monitor the duration, the claiming rates of your members by duration. Of course, those on waiting periods and honeymoons, as it can mask your true underlying claiming rates. Your product relativities, because of the risk of what can happen if you don't. And in introducing new products, the amount of data that you can base the price on is obviously a lot more limited than existing on the products that have a long history of experience. So in launching a new product, it can be worthwhile to consider, well, what's the demographic profile and what's the likely characteristics of those that we're likely to get? And specifically, if we don't get the people that we're hoping for, as everyone's trying to get the young members that don't claim anything, how much will our price have to change? Now, as I mentioned, this is about about an individual product, not a suite of products or an entire scenario or an entire insurer. So when an insurer does have 70 different products in a single state, to go through all these factors and look at them on an individual level can be a fair bit of work. And in some cases, it may not be material or worth the resources. But a likely scenario is that these factors may only be assessed in the event of a large increase in drawing rates. And in this situation, there may be a better desire to understand why drawing rates have increased and resources may be allocated accordingly. In this situation, it also may be asked whether the deterioration in performance could have been identified prior to materialising. Now, before opening up to questions, I just want to leave you with a couple of other bits of food for thought. Now, in assessing and quantifying insurance risk in the industry, a technique that's not uncommon is to go for to look at the variance of historical drawing rates and look at the volatility in previous performance and use that as a variance and apply some sort of stochastic approach or probability of ruin. In applying such approach, however, it may not encapsulate a number of the factors that I've spoken about today. I mean, how would that incorporate the uncertainty around having 30% of the members only being with the insurer for 2 years? How would that incorporate a new product being offered? How would that incorporate products being consolidated? So given these factors are, well, at least in my view, pertinent risks, How would you go about quantifying these? And how would you link them into your capital management plan and to your risk appetite? Now, we spoke in the previous session, there was a bit of discussion around what the tipping point is for the price of premiums in the industry, and when is it really going to bite and have a large impact. So I just want to share with you some comments from Treasury's intergenerational report and give support to, well, what's going to be the appropriate price in the next couple of decades, and will this price be affordable? The Treasury's intergenerational report outlines that health spending is projected to grow from 4% of GDP in 2009-2010 to 7.1% of GDP in 40 years' time. It also expects that health spending per person will more than treble over the next 40 years. Now, when I first read this, I'm not sure I should admit this, but it seemed a little bit abstract that, okay, this is what's going to happen going forward and, you know, these are things to be mindful of. And it wasn't until I worked backwards from this and calculated an annual rate that it really hit home. Now, in terms of the increase health spending to more than treble per person over the next 40 years, that equates to around 2.9% real or 5.4% nominal. Another extract from Treasury's report is that it says that the private health insurance rebate is expected to grow from $192 real per capita in 2012-2013 to $390 real per capita in 2022-23, an increase of over 50% in real spending per person. And if you work that out on a per yearly rate, it's about 5.2% per year, or 7.7% nominal. And every year, and when you suddenly look at the annual increases and have a look at the annual increases that insurers put their prices up, which is in the vicinity of 6-7%, which, while completely justifiable when you look at the cost pressures, every year the prices increase an amount above average weekly earnings, the proportion of household budgets allocated to PHI premiums increases. And of course, if you compound this over 10, 20, 40 years, these are the sort of impacts. So are we looking at potentially private health insurance premiums being 3 or 6 times as much as they are now? And if that's the case, will they be affordable? I'd like to leave you with that and open up for any discussion or questions that you may have.
Andrew Gale.
Thanks, Carl. It's you provide us with yet another opportunity this convention to talk about health insurance, which some of us just can't refuse. I just wanted to just make a couple of remarks about some of the earlier slides you had, I think, particularly around state differences. And it's interesting, you know, we talk about the appropriate price for a community-rated product, and we don't have one community. We have at least 7 communities, that's states, and perhaps we've got thousands of communities because each product effectively is its own community in that way. So it's interesting to think about community rating like that. And, of course, there are significant variations in the age profile in the private health insurance communities in each state and in the populations in each state. And we know that the Northern Territory has a very small proportion of older population, and that's mirrored in the insurance population, and Western Australia is also quite a young population. And we know that age is a very important factor in private health insurance hospital claims costs, so therein lies a very large reason for the differences in prices that are reflected in those very properly priced differences that you referred to. And it's interesting to think about community rating in those different environments and risk equalisation. And some people think that the reasons we have state-based risk equalisation is an historical one because health insurers were traditionally state-based, and Very few health insurers had operations in more than one state. But in fact, that's not the case, and we actually did have a national reinsurance or risk equalisation arrangement at the very beginning, and it only changed after political process and industry debate. The state-based pricing is frustrating from time to time. You could think about the situation where people move from one state of residence to another and then are told by their health insurer that there is a large adjustment in their premium, sometimes down but sometimes up, and for no apparent reason, seemingly, to that individual, their risk hasn't changed. And particularly frustrating in border communities like Albury, Wodonga and Tweed Heads, Coolangatta, where actually people can buy their health insurance across the border from the same fund. It's very frustrating to try and explain that to people. This issue was talked about by the Industry Commission in 1997, but seemingly there's no appetite to take on the negatives of big price adjustments in Northern Territory and West Australia for perhaps very small price reductions in other states. But it's interesting to consider whether using state as a pricing and risk equalisation pooling factor actually supports or subverts the community rating objectives of the legislation.
Thanks, Andrew.
Not sure if that microphone's working, so you can come and use this one.
John Robinson from AMP. I'm not very much a novice in the health insurance area, but I just want to make a couple of comments on your last piece, both from a personal perspective and just thinking more from a understanding what the long-term implications are. One, personally, given my ageing, the 7% rate of increase doesn't sound too scary to me, mainly because I expect my claim rates to be going up faster than that. So it seems like a pretty good trade-off. And personally, over the last decade, my wife's done a very good job of making sure that our claim rates on our private insurance exceed our actual premium payments. So I think it's personally a very good trade-off, personally. But I think what's hiding in behind that is the fact that your actual claim rates and stuff, that's probably, I don't know what's in behind intergenerational, that's probably reflecting a view of what's happening across the population, not health versus private versus public. And I suspect what you're going to see in the private space, if you look at those sort of dynamics, is us who are older are going to be claiming faster and furiously. Those sort of rate hikes are sort of sitting there, and you see it partly in private schools as well, but costs are going to be attractive to those already in the system. Your big issue is that you're not going to be very unattractive increasingly to those who you're trying to get into the system with the low claim rates. And that's going to mean that your actual claim rates are probably going to go up a lot faster than those figures in the private space.
Yeah, potentially. And that's, you know, one of the issues the industry is going to have to look to address. And while, you know, your premium is often compared to how much you claim, and while, you know, you're claiming a lot more than what you're paying, it's great value. But for most people, the opposite is true, and the premium they pay is a lot more than what they actually claim. So how are you going to entice people to pay increasingly more when they're not really claiming anything? And I think it'll be an interesting issue going forward.
If I may jump in, Carl, just another sort of food for thought question. To what extent do you think having a premium application approval process, you know, once a year, 1 April, the minister can say no to your rate increase, affect the price? So, for example, if that went away, would insurers then, you know, have less uncertainty and could change rates more quickly and reactively, and therefore prices may reflect sort of, you know, less buffer, less risk margins, and so on?
Gee, that's a loaded question. I'm also aware there's a representative from the Department of Health in the room that has a very close involvement in the premium process and I believe actually runs it. Would you like to make a comment on that at all?
I think there's two, Alistair Wilson, there's two parts to it. One is, you know, whether it's once a year, so in terms of responding to pricing, I think even if we removed the process of approval, it'd be likely that there'd be some other item put into place that meant you could only change prices once a year. And in terms of whether there was no approval process required at all, well, I'm not sure there'll be significant change to pricing, because the argument most insurers put to us is that they're asking for what they need anyway, and any adjustments that are generally made are quite minor. But I guess it opens up the sort of a bigger picture question about whether removal of that pricing regulation would be a catalyst for rethinking a whole lot of things happening in PHI, and I guess that's a really unknown question. So, you know, maybe it might, something dramatic might happen, but, you know, it's difficult to say.
Sorry, John Fader. I'm from Southern Cross in Auckland. So I just want to talk to that last slide pretty briefly. I don't think the picture is not a worrying picture for health insurance or health costs, but I have seen some economic work suggesting that as standards of living increase, like if we go back 100 years, a proportion of GDP that might have been spent on essentials like food, shelter, quite a very, very significant proportion of income would be spent on those items. GDP growth is a function of improvements in standard of living, and the fact is that health is actually facilitating an improvement in standard of living. So people are prepared to spend more on health as GDP grows. So the position, while I think there's a problem, I don't think it's as big as what's shown there.
If I can come back to something, to Ben's comment about the premium approval process. And if you look at, I mean, I guess one of the big outcomes is you're going to look at the profitability of the industry. And as an industry, the profit margin is still quite thin. So to have a look at, well, would the profit be different overall if, in the absence of this process, I think it's kind of an interesting question. And I guess the other part of that is whether the process encourages sufficient investment in claims management processes and broader health to kind of justify that. And in terms of claims management, to be honest, at least to me, it seems more of an issue around the current risk equalisation arrangements than perhaps necessarily the pricing approval process to create that incentive.
Thanks, Gulf. Thomas Terran, Merrill Lynch. I'm also a novice in private health insurance, and one of the charts that I was particularly interested in is the difference for the same product between insurers. And one of the questions that instantly comes to mind is, why isn't the member base more mobile if they saw that and they could, and there's a huge opportunity to save? And it seems to me it is a dormant member base to a large extent at the moment. But when the pricing gets to a point where it starts to get problematic for the household budget, do you see a problem for the industry with a more mobile member base? I know it's not happening at the moment, but it could be in future with the likes of the iSelects and other comparison services. It could become a problem, and essentially it's a challenge for pricing and community rating, because essentially you're pricing based on your modelling of what your member base is going to look like, and that's going to be a lot more volatile going forward.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that's potentially a large issue. I mentioned during the presentation that some insurers may be able to charge a lower premium just because they cover a group of people that have a lower claiming pattern. Now, if that changes and they get new members on board, then obviously that may very well change. So I think that's something that perhaps insurers should consider in deciding whether or not they should go on iSelect and to monitor the sort of members that they're getting, and whether they're consistent with their existing membership.
If I may ask another sort of controversial question. In your experience in all the five previous premium application rounds, has there been many price reductions? So I guess I'm thinking if say, experience turns out to be fantastic and there's potential reason for cutting prices. Has that come through in many applications?
One of the reasons that I was standing up here as myself rather than representing the views of organisations I'm affiliated with was in the hope of avoiding those sort of questions. Evidently, that wasn't as successful as I had planned. I think it's an interesting question about whether, you know, if you look at the factors I've spoken about, whether that would suggest that there'd be a lot more volatility in price changes of products over time than necessarily what we're seeing, at least in published data. And I'd probably say that was, well, when we see published data, it's, you know, obviously aggregated from all the insurers' products. So if you were to have a look at the detail of that on a state basis and on a product level, you'd see a lot more volatility, which, of course, that's going to be smoothed over time.
Any more questions? Peter?
I'll try and make this Peter Leary. Try and make this a question to you, Carl, rather than a comment. But it might be something you didn't actually look at, and that is the differential in gross margin between hospital and general treatment products. And if you've got any comments around that, because I guess in my view, while we've heard a lot of success in the role of actuaries getting into health insurance. We've heard a lot about that at this convention, and undoubtedly it is true, but I think it's one area where actuaries have failed pretty hopelessly.
Sorry, Peter, can I just get you to elaborate on the latter part of what you just said? I didn't quite follow that.
In terms of equalising gross margins.
Yeah, that's an issue, and it's interesting the current practice in applying the liability adequacy test has seemingly recently changed from applying it separately for your general and hospital components, which it was previously, to now it's looking at it at a more aggregated level. So when you're assessing your risk, at least for accounting standards purposes, you can look at a whole portfolio. And it's also something you can bring up as well in terms of that most people do have both products, so perhaps you can manage them as a single portfolio. And those kind of younger members and particularly families that do have lower hospital claims generally have higher general claims, so there is a bit of a balancing out there in effect. Depending on a product, it does vary a little bit, but you can make the argument that can balance out. In subsidising hospital with general, though, it can be a little bit of a risk, as it is dependent on a person's having the same level of general and hospital, having both products and having a suitable level of them. And particularly when you're looking at consider when the sticks and carrots approach that are largely used to encourage people to take out private health insurance are looking at being seriously reviewed, whether they're still going to be sustainable going forward. You know, if there are changes to the Medicare rebate and the tiers come in, what's that going to do to people covered under general treatments? Yeah, there is no really stick there. There is not a big stick for people not to have general cover. So if you're relying on cross-subsidisation and that does materialise, then and you're relying on general to subsidise your hospital, then that may be an issue.
Any more questions? We'll probably have time for one more. No? All right. Please join me in thanking Carl in his very thought-provoking paper. He is one of the newer brigade of health actuaries, so very encouraging to see more actuaries, you know, presenting at the conventions other than Andrew, Grant, Stuart, etc. So please thank Carl.